Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 207. It's Monday, April 17th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's start with a couple quick COVID-19 related stories. First up from the Washington Post, White House launching $5 billion program to speed coronavirus vaccines. The Biden administration is launching a $5 billion-plus program to accelerate development of new coronavirus vaccines and treatments, seeking to better protect against a still-mutating virus, as well as other coronaviruses that might threaten us in the future. Project Next Gen, the long-anticipated follow-up to Operation Warp Speed, the Trump-era program that sped coronavirus vaccines to patients in 2020, would take a similar approach to partnering with private sector companies to expedite development of vaccines and therapies. Scientists, public health experts, and politicians have called for the initiative, warning that existing therapies have steadily lost their effectiveness and that new ones are needed. It's been very clear to us that the market on this is moving very slowly, Ashish Jha, the White House coronavirus coordinator, said. There is a lot that government can do, the administration can do, to speed up these tools for the American people. Jha and others said the new effort will focus on three goals: creating long-lasting monoclonal antibodies after an evolving virus rendered many current treatments ineffective, accelerating development of vaccines that produce mucosal immunity, that's like you can get vaccines in the nose, which is thought to reduce transmission and infection risk, and speeding efforts to develop pan-coronavirus vaccines to guard against new SARS-CoV variants as well as other coronaviruses. Experts have said that government commitments are crucial to accelerating the pace of next-generation therapies. Even some of the Republicans who blocked the White House coronavirus funding request last year said they wanted a Warp Speed 2.0 to rush updated vaccines and treatments that would better fight the virus. And next up from Stat News, the Biden administration will hang on to some COVID pandemic emergency powers. Even though the Biden administration is ending its highest-profile COVID-19 emergency declaration next month, it's still going to hold on to some pandemic-era powers. The Department of Health and Human Services gave governors a heads-up last Friday that is planning to keep pharmacists' ability to administer COVID-19 and flu vaccines past the end of the public health emergency. The rules that let pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, and pharmacy interns give COVID-19 vaccines and tests and seasonal flu vaccines will stay in place through December 2024. The White House's test-to-treat program that allows pharmacists to test people for COVID-19 and prescribe the antiviral Paxlovid will also continue. Normally, pharmacists have the ability to administer some vaccines, but the detail of which products they can give varies from patient to patient. They can give patients vary from state to state. The Department of Health and Human Services declaration ensures that the policy will be uniform for at least the next 2 years. And next up, a very interesting story. It sort of relates to U.S. exceptionalism. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Traditional values closely linked to following COVID-19 precautions, except in the U.S. A new study from researchers at the University of California, L.A., shows that U.S. population's response to COVID-19 precautions stood in sharp contrast to other countries. Worldwide, people who profess to have more traditional or socially conservative values were more likely to adhere to COVID-19 recommendations. But in the United States, people with those values were more likely to dismiss such recommendations. The authors of the study explained that those who value tradition are more likely to practice threat avoidance, and thus were more eager to take COVID-19 precautions. The effect was seen in different regions worldwide, with the strongest effect seen in China, India, the Philippines, Chile, and Italy. Both poor and rich countries displayed this link between traditionalism and threat avoidance, but the effect was most weakly correlated in the United States, Canada, Poland, Austria, and Indonesia. The author suggests that in the United States, and to some effect Canada, those with traditional values perceive threats to the economy and personal liberty more strongly than the threat posed to COVID-19. Moreover, the U.S. population in particular showed more distrust in scientists. In countries where the discourse around science and trust was less polarized, traditionalists were more willing to embrace precautions than their more socially liberal counterparts, study co-author Daniel Fessler said. The U.S., where these topics were highly politicized, suffered more COVID-19 deaths per capita than any other highly developed nation. In general, the author said their findings show it is crucial to recognize and understand how traditional-minded people react to viral illness threats, as corrective action may prove vital as humanity confronts worldwide threats, from emerging pandemics to climate change, that can only be overcome through innovation and the adoption of new practices. Okay, moving on to a couple stories about gun violence. First up from Medical Express, 1 in 5 American adults say they have a relative killed by a gun. Nearly 20% of the American population has had a family member killed by a gun, including by suicide, and 1 in 6 has witnessed a shooting, a new survey found. The survey also found that 4% have shot a gun in self-defense, and 4% have been injured by a gun. For black adults, the numbers were even higher, attesting to greater gun violence in minority communities. About 1/3 of black adults had a family member killed by a gun, compared to 17% of white adults and 18% of Hispanic adults. Black adults were also twice as likely as white adults to say they witnessed someone being shot, with about 31% of black adults reporting this compared with 14% of white adults and 22% of Hispanic adults. Many survey respondents reported living in fear of gun violence. Many others reported owning guns that are improperly stored. About 1/3 of both Hispanic and black adults said they worry daily or almost daily that a family member will become a victim of gun violence. Among white adults, about 10% feel that concern daily. Parents of children under age 18 are more likely to report this fear, with about 24% of parents reporting daily worry compared to 15% of other adults. Among black adults, 1 in 6 adults does not feel at all safe from guns in their neighborhoods, a far greater segment than the 2% of white people and 9% of Hispanic people who feel that way. Gun ownership is common, the survey also found. About 4 in 10 adults, including many with children, say they live in homes that have guns. Moreover, about 3/4 of people with guns in their homes say they are not stored using common gun safety practices. That includes 52% who say their gun is stored near its ammunition, and 44% who say the gun is kept unlocked. More than 1/3 say that a gun in their home is stored loaded. About 1/3 of parents in gun-owning households store the weapon in an unlocked location, and approximately the same number store a loaded gun. About 61% admitted storing a gun in the same location as ammunition. Some have had conversations about guns with health professionals, including their child's pediatrician. About 26% report that their child's doctor has asked about guns in the house, and 8% said they've talked about gun safety. A significantly smaller percentage of people without children in the home said they've talked about guns with their doctor. And next up, an article that gets to that perpetually asked question after a mass shooting happens, why? This from Medical Express. Why do mass shooters kill? It's about more than having a grievance. An acutely troubling aspect of life in contemporary America is the growing proliferation of mass shootings that claim thousands of innocent lives year after painful year and make everyone feel unsafe. The year 2023 is still young, and already we've had at least 146 mass shooting events in the U.S. on record, including the killing of 5 people in a Louisville, Kentucky bank where the shooter live streamed. There were 647 mass shootings in 2022, 693 in 2021, resulting in 859 and 920 deaths respectively, with no respite in sight from this ghastly epidemic. Since 2015, over 19,000 people have been shot or wounded or killed in mass shootings. In the wake of most shootings, the news media and public reflexively ask, what was the killer's motive? As a psychologist who studies violence and extremism, I understand the question immediately pops to mind because of the bizarre nature of the attacks, the quote, out-of-the-blue shock that they produce, and people's need to comprehend and reach closure on what initially appears to be completely senseless and irrational. But what would constitute a satisfactory answer to the public's question? Media reports typically describe shooters' motives based on specific individual details of the case, on their manifestos or social media postings. These generally list insults, humiliations, or rejections by coworkers, potential romantic partners, or schoolmates that a perpetrator may have suffered. Or they may cite alleged threats to the shooter's group from some imagined enemy, such as Jews, people of color, Muslims, Asians, or members of the LGBTQ+ community. Though perhaps informative about a given perpetrator's way of thinking, I believe these motives are too specific. Each shooter's life story is unique, yet the growing number of mass shootings suggests a general trend that transcends personal details. Perhaps surprisingly, the general motive that drives mass shootings is a fundamental human need. It's everyone's quest for significance and a feeling that their life matters. That need gets activated when someone feels the loss of significance, the sense of being slighted, humiliated, or excluded, but also when there's an opportunity to gain in one's sense of significance, being the object of admiration, a hero, or a martyr in other people's eyes. A 2020 review of mass shooting incidents between the years 2010 and 2019 found that 78% of mass shooters in that period were motivated by fame-seeking or attention-seeking, that is, by the quest for significance. If the need for significance is so fundamental and universal, how is it that mass shootings is an isolated phenomenon perpetrated by a handful of desperate individuals and not by everyone? Two factors can push this common human striving into mayhem and destruction. First, it takes extreme heights of significance craving to pay this high price for a potential notoriety. Shooting is an extreme act that demands self-sacrifice, not only giving up on acceptance in the mainstream society, but also producing a high likelihood of dying in shootouts with law enforcement. And as I've reported on before, suicidality is also tightly related to mass shootings. Most people who do mass shootings do not mind dying or actually intend to be killed in the process. Research shows that about 25 to 31% of mass shooters exhibit signs of mental illness, which is likely to induce them into a deep sense of disempowerment and insignificance. But even the remaining 70-75% with no known pathologies are likely to have suffered extreme significance issues, as attested by their ample statements about humiliation, rejection, and exclusion they believe they or their group suffered at the hands of some real or imagined culprits. These feelings can create a one-track significance focus that can ultimately precipitate a mass shooting. Yet even someone who really wants to feel significant is not necessarily going to carry out a mass shooting. The shortcut to stardom. In fact, most highly motivated people satisfy their egos quite differently. They focus their extremism on various socially approved areas: business, sports, the arts, the sciences, or politics. Why would some then choose the repugnant road to infamy, paved by the massacre of innocents? There is a method to this madness. The shocked public attention a shooting attracts delivers instantaneous, quote, significance. Climbing the steep hill of a respectable career, however, is fraught with obstacles and uncertainties. Success is elusive, takes ages to attain, and is inequitably afforded to those with unusual ability, grit, or privilege, or some combination of these. Committing a mass shooting represents a widely available shortcut to, quote, stardom. There are over 390 million guns in today's America, and a lack of background checks in many states. People have the freedom to purchase assault weapons at a local store. Thus, planning and executing a mass shooting is a road to notoriety open to anyone. And the narrative that links gun violence to significance, that is the idea that by becoming a mass shooter you become famous, has been spreading ever wider with each successive shooting. Killings celebrated. A final puzzle is this. If significance and respect are what the shooters are after, how come they do things that most people despise? In today's fractured public sphere dominated by social media, it is easy to find networks of supporters and admirers for nearly anything under the sun, including the most repugnant and unconscionable acts of cruelty and callousness. In fact, there is ample evidence that mass shooters are celebrated by appreciative audiences and can serve as role models to other would-be heroes who seek to outscore them in casualty counts. What my colleagues and I call the three N's, need, narrative, and network refer to the would-be shooter's need to become significant or notorious, the narrative that says being a shooter means being important, and the network that exists to support such behavior. They together combine into a toxic mixture, driving a person to carry out a mass shooting. But this framework also suggests how the tide of this horrific epidemic may be stemmed. Negating the narrative that depicts violence as an easy path to significance and dismantling the networks that support that narrative. The two go together, disproving the narrative that gun violence is an easy route to fame by making it hard to obtain guns, for instance, and reducing media attention to shooters would reduce the appeal of gun violence to people seeking to feel more significant. It is equally important to identify and make available alternative paths to significance conveyed in alternative narratives. This would likely require a concerted effort across society and its institutions. Understanding the psychology of it all may be a necessary precondition for taking effective steps in this direction. Well, there you go, folks. At Just for the Health of It, you often get answers to questions that are perpetually asked with a puzzling blank face by standard media. Next up, from the Houston Chronicle, rural residents are more depressed and anxious than those in urban areas. While people might associate remote settings with peaceful landscapes and quiet lifestyles, rural residents experience more depression and anxiety than their urban counterparts, a new University of Houston study has found. The research did not assess why people living in rural areas reported worse psychological well-being and higher levels of neuroticism, but researchers and advocates believe some of the findings align with scarcer mental health resources outside of larger cities, a well-documented national problem. Atherton, the study's lead author, said her research team pulled from two major studies that surveyed about 20,000 American adults over the course of 25 years in midlife in the United States and the Health and Retirement Study. The respondents answered questions that pointed to the big five personality traits: extroversion, agreeableness, openness, conscientiousness, and neuroticism, as well as their psychological well-being and life satisfaction. The team found high reports of depression and anxiety in rural areas, plus a tendency of people there to be less open-minded, less conscientious, and more neurotic. But rural Americans had about the same life satisfaction as those in urban settings, researchers wrote in the Journal of Psychology. Study author Marquita Winona Lewis-Tame said personality differences are under-researched subjects that could have practical effects for health workers who are seeking to solve issues in more far-flung communities. You had this idea of coming in and saying, "Let me help you with your mental health," and they're like, "Who the freak are you?" said Lewis-Tame, assistant professor at Northwestern University School of Medicine. That's supported by lower personality trait levels of openness. Next up, pain is not that uncommon. This from Medical Express. About 20% of U.S. adults experienced chronic pain in 2021. An estimated 21% of U.S. adults experienced chronic pain during 2021, according to research published in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. The researchers found that an estimated 21% of U.S. adults experienced chronic pain during 2021, and 7% experienced high-impact pain. And that's 52 million people that have experienced chronic pain and 17 million people that have experienced high-impact chronic pain. Next up from Healthline, sexually transmitted infection increase. Syphilis cases spike 74% in 4 years. Sexually transmitted infections like syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea continued to rise in 2021, a new report from the CDC says. Over 2.5 million sexually transmitted infections were reported in the United States in 2021, marking a 7% increase in cases between 2017 and 2021. Cases of increases in syphilis saw the biggest spike, growing by 32% between 2020 and 2021. The CDC says the COVID-19 pandemic, which drove many people to forego or delay prevention services like testing, contributed to the spread of sexually transmitted infections. Even before the pandemic hit, however, sexually transmitted infections were on the rise, a trend that has disproportionately impacted ethnic minority groups, gay and bisexual men, and people younger than age 25. Rates of sexually transmitted infections continue to increase in the U.S. with alarming numbers over the past few years. Changes in sexual behavior with a decrease in condom use, decrease in prevention and testing efforts are likely the major contributors to the increase in sexually transmitted infections in the U.S., said Dr. Marcia Alcade, infectious disease specialist at the University of Miami Health System. why syphilis is spreading the fastest. Between 2020 and 2021 alone, syphilis rose by 32%. While most of new syphilis cases occur among men who have sex with men, we are also seeing an increased number of cases among women, which reflects the increase in congenital syphilis, Dr. Alcade said. Dr. Irene Stafford, a maternal fetal physician medicine physician and associate professor of OB-GYN at the medical school at UT Health Houston, says syphilis is often a silent infection that presents with no symptoms. The rash and lesions of early syphilis can be asymptomatic, and after they clear, an infected individual is unaware that they are still infected, she says. People who are infected can then unknowingly spread it to others through skin-to-skin contact or mucosal contact with an infected person. Transmission is easier than with other STIs, sexually transmitted infections, that are transmitted through sexual intercourse, says Alcade. Many STIs can be asymptomatic in certain individuals, however, left untreated. They can lead to complications like chronic pelvic pain, pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, pregnancy complications, and an increased risk of contracting infections like HIV and infant death. Syphilis, for example, is more common in reproductive age people, including pregnant women. STI screenings and open conversation should be part of all routine healthcare visits, according to Stafford, not just when people have behavioral risk factors. This discussion should include an open dialogue about practices and behaviors that might increase your risks of STIs. To combat the spread of sexually transmitted infections, she thinks more non-traditional settings like emergency rooms should be screening patients for STIs. Consistent condom use, early diagnosis, treatments, and vaccinations can all help stop the spread of sexually transmitted infections. Well, next up, a story that highlights the fact that while many screenings are underused, some are overused. This from MedPage Today. Older men still overscreen for prostate cancer. Older men are being overscreened for prostate cancer despite U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidelines against prostate-specific antigen, PCA, testing in men ages 70 and up, a survey studying showed. Among a cohort of over 30,000 men, recent PSA screening rates were 55% for men aged 70 to 74, 52% for those aged 75 to 79, and 39% for those aged 80 and above, reported Sanja Kalavakacherla, from the University of California San Diego School of Medicine, reported in JAMA Network Open. Of note, discussing PSA testing advantages with a clinician was associated with increased recent testing, whereas discussing PSA testing disadvantages had no association with screening. This suggests that any discussion of PSA testing likely occurs in the context of a clinician or patient-initiated effort to ultimately screen for prostate cancer. So apparently, if anybody talks about it, it tends to be testing one way or the other. Okay, next up, an interesting facet of the changes in folks being taken off Medicaid that's happening now and probably over the next year. This from NBC News. Millions expected to lose dental care coverage after Medicaid review. More than 14 million adults across the United States who receive Medicaid are at risk of losing dental health coverage now that the COVID public health emergency is over, according to data exclusively obtained by NBC News. An issue that few have identified, however, is that about 14 million people, or 20% of adults currently enrolled in Medicaid, will lose their dental health coverage, according to the data compiled by CareQuest Institute for Oral Health, a think tank dedicated to oral health in the country. As many as 47 states give some form of dental health coverage to Medicaid recipients, providing either emergency care, limited coverage, or extensive dental services. The loss of care could have an outsized effect on communities of color. About 25% of adults with Medicaid see a dentist annually, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, though it can be difficult to find a dentist who accepts Medicaid. Those sounding the alarm about the issue point to numerous studies that link poor dental hygiene with a person's overall health. These links have become a rallying cry for many in the dental world in recent decades, as a landmark U.S. Surgeon General study published in 2000 found that a person's oral health could put a person at greater risk for other health issues. But preventative dental care can keep people from emergency room visits, saving patients, hospitals, and states from costly ER care. States have to balance that long-term cost saving, however, with the potential immediate savings to state and federal budgets by slashing dental coverage. Is that not the story of prevention? Whatever. It saves money in the long run, but let's save money now. Yeah, Brilliant. The need is there. According to CareQuest Institute report last year, 55% of adults reported some type of oral health problem. More than half of adults with a problem did not seek care, and 27% did not seek care because they could not afford it. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up I want to do a little bit longer and a detailed study that will talk about coal plant regulations from potential wastewater contamination. And that's something we often take for granted is, you know, the safety and quality of like our food supply or just basically air and water. But this is a really huge health issue. This from Energy News. Proposed federal rule would regulate coal plant wastewater for the first time. The EPA has for the first time proposed rules that would impose standards on wastewater release from coal plants, including contaminated water that is seeped through coal ash and water drained from coal ash impoundments in preparation for closing. Thus far, coal plants have had much leeway in essentially dump contaminated wastewater into lakes and rivers, including wastewater from scrubbers that remove sulfur dioxide from emissions and water used to clean bottom ash out of boilers. Coal plant wastewater has until now been subject only to 1982 standards that allow it to be deposited in coal ash ponds, where it may overflow into water bodies and contribute to the contamination of groundwater that happens at the vast majority of coal ash sites. Pretty much all these plants, whether sitting on the shores of the Great Lakes or rivers or streams, they've historically drawn water from the source and discharged pollution back into it, said Earth Justice Senior Attorney Thomas Kamar. Some plants literally have for decades been able to get away with never having to do anything other than just use an ash pond, historically considered part of their wastewater treatment system. They're letting the pollution flow right into waterway like it's an open sewer. This has been a long fight where the practice is finally going to end. The EPA estimates the proposed wastewater rule released March 7th would prevent over 584 million pounds of pollutants, including arsenic and mercury, from being discharged into U.S. waterways annually. The EPA will hold online public hearings on April 20th and 25th, and public comments can be submitted through May 30th. Following these steps, the EPA will finalize and implement the rule. The rule proposes a standard of zero pollutants discharged from water used in scrubbers and boilers and requires the best available technology to achieve this goal. Filtration with fine membranes, chemical treatment, and recycling water back into the plant can avoid pollution from these wastewater streams. The rule also, for the first time, requires that leachate, water that becomes contaminated passing through coal ash ponds, be treated with chemicals to remove or neutralize the pollution. The new mandates may hasten the closure of coal plants nationwide, experts say, if coal plant operators elect to close sooner rather than invest in the required technology. Laws like the Clean Water Act that rely on the best available technology are meant to be periodically updated as technology improves. In 2010, Earth Justice filed a lawsuit demanding coal plant wastewater standards, and in 2015, the EPA proposed standards. But that proposal was never finalized, and the Trump administration instead rolled back protections. EPA introduced loopholes and extended the compliance deadlines, which all added up to pretty significant weakening of the rule, when in fact this is a rule that the EPA is required to update regularly for all polluting industries based on what technology is out there to reduce and ultimately eliminate pollution, Kamar said. Now we're eager to see EPA follow through with the strongest rule possible as quickly as possible. The proposed rule does not cover the contamination that seeps from unlined coal ash ponds into groundwater. That pollution is regulated by 2015 coal ash rules that require monitoring, cleanup, and an end to such groundwater pollution. For years, regulators and companies have largely ignored those mandates, but in the past year and a half, the EPA has been actively enforcing them. The newly proposed rule under the Clean Water Act is the other side of the coal ash coin, as Kamar described it, covering water drained from ponds when they are being emptied and leachate that is sometimes collected from coal ash impoundments. Such leachate collection is an effort to avoid groundwater contamination, but an effort that ultimately becomes futile if that leachate is then released into water bodies without adequate treatment. Kamar said the new requirement for leachate is the first of its kind and a significant improvement, but the proposed rule is more open-ended in regards to water drained from coal ash ponds as they are being emptied and closed. The rule proposed to deal with such legacy wastewater on a site-by-site basis. EPA has never set a federal standard around the treatment of that type of dewatering, Kumar said. This rule for legacy wastewater continues to defer to site-by-site analysis, which will primarily mean that states are the ones making the decisions. Meanwhile, the proposed rule exempts plants from new mandates if they promise to stop burning coal by 2028, or in some cases, by December 2029. It also allows plants that have already installed less effective wastewater pollution controls to keep operating through 2032 without further upgrades. These delays could mean the plants closing coal ash ponds before these deadlines and are able to release the resulting wastewater and leachate without meeting any new requirements. If those sites are all closing between now and 2029, the proposed rule is effectively saying go ahead and drain those ponds, and no additional treatment will be required unless the state requires it. The 2015 federal coal ash rules don't cover plants closed before the rules took effect, but an Illinois state coal ash law covers such legacy sites. Dynegy Midwest Generation is planning to empty coal ash from ponds on the bank of the Middle Fork of the Vermilion River in southern Illinois and move the ash to a dry landfill on higher ground. Advocates have long fought for closing the coal ash ponds to protect the Vermilion River from seepage and possible collapse of ash held back by the eroding banks. Dynegy plans to build a trench to collect leachate from the coal ash as it is being removed, a plan advocates support. But they are concerned that the polluted water from the trench will ultimately make its way into the river after being placed in a secondary treatment pond, as Dynegy proposes. Ironically, if Dynegy proceeds with its plan, the removal of the ash that advocates sought to prevent from polluting the river could ultimately mean the contamination still makes its way into the river. It's the old argument about dilution being the solution to pollution, Kumar said. It's what we've been working against in this space for so many years, especially with a sensitive waterway like the Middle Fork, a naturally meandering stream that thousands of people each year use for canoeing and kayaking. An uncontrolled release of pollution should not be allowed. Local advocates are asking the Illinois EPA to deny Dynegy's proposal and, in permits the company needs, require stringent treatment of any wastewater or leachate before it is discharged. A spokesperson for Vistra, Dynegy's parent company, did not respond to requests for comments. The way these permits are structured is usually for continual discharge, Wren says. You're a coal plant. You'll be regularly discharging the wastewater. Here are your limits. They don't really contemplate the single activity of dewatering that takes a few months but is not a continuous activity. We fought hard for more monitoring while they're discharging this highly concentrated stuff. The proposed federal rule similarly does not provide for especially frequent monitoring of intense wastewater releases during a coal ash dewatering. So yeah, it's kind of like dealing with tax lawyers. There's always some way to get around it, and often the delays make the regulation meaningless. So hey, hopefully the strongest rules get passed as quickly as possible. Well, another regulatory action, this from Reuters, Juul to pay $462 million to six U.S. states and D.C. over youth addiction claims. E-cigarette maker Juul Labs, Inc. agreed to pay $462 million over 8 years to settle claims by six U.S. states, including New York and California, along with D.C., and that it unlawfully marketed its addictive products to minors. The deal, which also included Colorado, Illinois, Massachusetts, and New Mexico, means that the San Francisco-based Juul has now settled with 45 states for more than $1 billion, putting most of the long-running litigation over its business practices to rest. The company did not admit wrongdoing in the settlement. The various states that accused Juul of falsely marketing its e-cigarettes as less addictive than cigarettes and targeted minors with glamorous advertising campaigns. In addition to the state settlements, the company last year agreed to pay $1.7 billion to settle thousands of lawsuits by local government entities and individual consumers. Juul's former largest investor, Marlboro cigarette maker Altria Group, Inc., is also facing claims over its alleged role in marketing Juul's e-cigarettes and has not settled. Most e-cigarettes contain nicotine, the addictive substance present in regular cigarettes, cigars, and other tobacco products. And nicotine in adolescence can harm the parts of the brain that control attention, learning, mood, and impulse control, according to the CDC. The CDC also has said using nicotine in adolescence may raise the risk for future addiction to other drugs. And in other regulatory news, this also from MedPage Today, all opioid pain meds to get new safety warnings, FDA says. So there's actually a whole bunch of warnings which are included in this article, but I'm focusing on just this one here. The FDA is making several updates to prescribing information for opioid pain medications to provide guidance on safe use, according to drug safety communication, including a new warning that they can increase sensitivity to pain. I couldn't resist reporting on this because it's so ironic for most of you. Anybody who watches commercial TV at all has seen all these drug ads, and I find it's a scary proportion of them that actually report that one of the side effects is actually causing the disease or condition that they're trying to prevent. And how ironic it is that opioids, in some cases, can actually increase sensitivity to pain. Yikes. Okay, well, next up in the long, long incremental journey of trying to improve access to healthcare in America, this from Medical Express, Biden to expand access to healthcare for undocumented immigrants brought to U.S. as children. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants brought to the U.S. as children may soon be eligible to receive federally funded healthcare. President Joe Biden last Thursday announced the extension of eligibility for Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act health insurance exchanges to those in DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. While other classes of immigrants, such as those with temporary protected status and asylum seekers, can already purchase health insurance as part of the Affordable Care Act, the DACA participants have not had the opportunity because they do not meet the definition of having, quote, lawful presence in the United States. The Biden administration would change that. DACA, created in 2012, is meant to give children illegally brought to this country by their parents the opportunity to work legally and not be deported. They pay taxes, but they don't receive the same benefits as U.S. citizens. About 580,000 people were still enrolled in DACA in late 2022, according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. The Biden administration is taking an important step to expand access to health care for DACA beneficiaries, and though the formal reach of this expansion is delimited, it will apply to about 580,000 people, the benefits are resounding, Jamila Mishner, Associate Professor of Government and Policy at Cornell University, said in a statement. Evidence indicates that coverage expansions like this improve health outcomes and help rectify the systematic exclusion of immigrants from our healthcare system, an exclusion that drives and exacerbates racial and economic health inequities. There are also broader benefits to the entire healthcare system. Having sizable groups of people who live, work, go to school, and make their home in the U.S., but cannot access vital health benefits is bad for everyone, she explained. It makes preventive care less accessible, thus driving up the cost of emergency care. It proliferates sickness and vulnerability in ways that harms families, communities, and local economies. No one wins when immigrants cannot readily access health care. Still, the DACA program has faced its challenges. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is prevented from processing any new applications because of court challenges, and Congress can't reach an agreement on immigration reforms. While only about 8% of Americans currently don't have health insurance thanks to increased eligibility and subsidies, about half of 20 million immigrants don't have insurance, according to the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation. Okay, next up from MedPage Today, are nonprofit hospitals really giving back more than they get? Nonprofit hospitals in the U.S. spend less on their communities than they receive in tax breaks, resulting in a fair share deficit for what are ostensibly charitable organizations, according to a new report. A hospital index report from the Nonprofit Loan Institute found that 77% of the 1,773 nonprofit hospitals analyzed spent less on charity care and community investment than the estimated value of their tax breaks in 2020. With the equivalent of $14 billion in these fair share deficits, 18 million Americans could have had their medical debt cleared, and more than 600 rural hospitals at risk of closure could stay open. The report also noted that many hospitals with the highest disparities between tax breaks and community spending ended the year with high net incomes and received millions in COVID-19 relief funding. These hospitals ended the end of the year in the black, and significantly in the black beyond what they actually could have paid for their fair share deficit, said Vike Isani, a cardiologist and president of the Loan Institute. To fulfill U.S. tax requirements, nonprofit hospitals must spend part of their income on services that benefit their communities in exchange for their tax-exempt status. But some have argued the IRS definition of, quote, community benefits is too broad, letting hospitals off the hook in areas that might be losing potential tax revenues with little to show for it. Okay, well, last up in my regular reporting, I wanted to do an article from one of my favorite blogs on Substack is Your Local Epidemiologist. And it's basically an editorial on focus on communication, not misinformation, which is something I've tried to focus on. Because one of the strange things is that the human mind, when we hear something over and over, we tend to believe it, even if we know in the context every time we hear it that it's not true. It's just kind of the way our brain works. So actually focusing on good communication of accurate facts and building trust with an audience is one of the most important ways to overcome misinformation and disinformation, something I hope to do here on Just for the Health of It. So here it is. Focus on communication, not misinformation. A new bill introduced in Congress calls on the U.S. government to focus on combating misinformation. The Zero Draft, a proposed international pandemic treaty, calls on member states to do the same. The FDA is zeroing in on misinformation. Webinars galore are focusing on fighting misinformation to build trust. Even public libraries and schools are entering the fight against fake news. These efforts are amongst the latest in a wave of initiatives, and for good reason. Social media sites are flooded with inaccurate, misleading, and sometimes nefarious messaging about science and health. Too often, these falsehoods get traction. Research has found that the modern information ecosystem allows false news to spread 6 times faster, more broadly, and by more people than the truth. Public health has not kept up. The field has stumbled in communicating effectively during times of crisis. During the pandemic, ineffective or absent risk communication left people scrambling for up-to-date and relevant information about their health safety. Concurrently, producers of disinformation were busy intentionally sowing doubt and confusion. Together, these obstacles create an impossible landscape for people to navigate when making decisions about everyday life, like whether and when to travel, wear a mask, see grandparents, or attend a party. Meanwhile, researchers and policy experts are producing a steady stream of proposals to prevent the next pandemic. Too often, these plans do not even contain the word communication. What good is faster vaccine development if uptake is poor? If no one is proactively anticipating concerns, listening to people on the ground, and addressing their information needs from a place of empathy and authenticity, how will we influence evidence-based decision-making? We are on the wrong path. The wellspring of misinformation is effectively infinite compared to the scant resources of public health. It is unlikely that we will ever get ahead of the deluge. But there is another way forward. We must focus instead on getting our own house in order by improving core communications. Communication should feature in every pandemic preparedness and response plan, with the same seriousness of purpose as vaccine development or diagnostic testing. Supporting people with readily available, relevant, detailed information will help to restore confidence in public health and address the systemic weaknesses that encourage people to turn to misinformation in the first place. The biggest gaps in public health information are timeliness and volume. Messaging is too slow and too scant to meet the need. Public health organizations and officials must get more comfortable communicating quickly, continuously, and with empathy. For many organizations, this means expanding or just creating the scientific communication workforce. Officials must recognize that communicating with the public is an essential part of their mission, and energy and time allocations must reflect that. Also, the clearance processes for communication products must be dramatically thinned. Onerous clearance processes discourage frequent information sharing and can inadvertently erode key messages. And I'll just share here personally, when I worked at the local health department here, one of the many streams of things of why I left that field and that particular employment was they really shut down the ability to actually communicate with the media. But it had to go through, you know, chains of command. And media, particularly like TV and radio, they're going to do it for that day. And if it takes a day to get back to you, it basically makes it impossible to actually provide that kind of information to the public. Once these systems and people are in place, the content of what is communicated is critical. Crisis communication should not serve the interests of the players, but of the people. This means that messaging cannot hasten to reassure how much is being done by the responsible parties or how under control the situation is. The proper goal of communication is to tell people honestly and clearly what the situation is, what risks they face, and what they should do to keep themselves and their family safe. Missteps can be avoided by properly acknowledging uncertainty. What do we know? What do we not know? And how are we trying to find answers? Knowledge translation also must come from a place of empathy. People do not turn to media companies for their news. They turn to anchors and reporters whom they come to know and trust, warm bodies that they can relate to, and who appear consistently over time. We don't give the public enough opportunities to see and trust warm bodies in public health. Messages must be delivered by real people, preferably the same people, in a style that feels human. These challenges don't just apply to a pandemic. Health emergencies happen all the time, from the Mpox outbreak to the Earth, quake in Turkey to the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, communities are starved for good information, leading to unnecessary anxiety, confusion, frustration. That void is often filled with misinformation. Going forward, the public health community should double down on bolstering frequent, reliable communication for these crises, instead of attempting to bat back the torrent of misinformation. Public health is unlikely to win at combating misinformation, at least in the near term. We win by earning the ear and trust of the public, and we do that by communicating honestly, frequently, and directly. We must not lose sight of that mission. I am afraid it's a lesson we haven't yet learned. Well, I'd like to be a part of that solution. Thank you for listening to Just for the Health of It here on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, well, that brings us to the last segment, a regular segment of the episode. This is called Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list, and it's a long list. I tied at 30 bonus articles, the record that was set a couple episodes ago. First up, bonus article number one, what Ohio patients, providers, and advocates need to know about the mass disenrollment of Medicaid. So that's underway with the public health emergency ending. If you have questions about that, about Ohio Medicaid, that's the link to go to. Bonus article two, report outlines how plastic production harms human health, environment, and economy. So this is a good backgrounder on all those fronts about how dangerous plastic production is on many fronts. And an interesting example of that, bonus article three, trucks are still taking tainted waste out of East Palestine. One spilled this week. So even when we're transporting stuff and it spills and we're trying to move it out, it spills again. Yikes. Bonus article four, why is the chemical industry pitting public health against economic growth? So, you know, there's a trillion plus dollars of loss due to these chemicals being spewed into the environment that we have to deal with. So it's not only just a health issue, but it's actually an economic growth. And it's a false thing to say that you can't have health and economic growth. It's like sickness, of course, is a growth industry, but it's sick. Bonus article five, half of PFAS in drinking water not monitored by the EPA. So this means that in a lot of places that there is PFAS, these forever chemicals in drinking water, the EPA is not monitoring. And also, they're only monitoring a very limited number of PFAS chemicals when there's thousands of these chemicals, and it allows a way for chemical companies to actually switch the type of PFAS that they use to avoid it showing up in waterways and drinking water. Bonus article six, legal abortions fell by 6% in the 6 months after Dobbs new data shows. So we're starting to get data in on what the effect in kind of a post-Roe America is. And in that first 6 months, that 6% drop translates to tens of thousands of women. And those are the women who couldn't get an abortion at all. It's certainly there are hundreds of thousands of women who is made much, much more difficult. Bonus article seven, Texas mifepristone case could lead to other drug approval lawsuits, experts say. So this is just a good backgrounder on the fact that this type of case could really just shoot holes in the drug approval process by having anybody, because this deals with standing in the case that it could potentially loosen that you could have all these lawsuits that would just mess up the ability to regulate drugs. Bonus article eight, Missouri to limit gender-affirming care for both minors and adults. So this is kind of the canary in the coal mine here, is that states have been passing limits on gender-affirming care, typically talk about protecting children, et cetera, but actually this Missouri law actually applies equally to adults. So maybe it reveals the true agenda there. Get rid of it all. Get rid of trans people or the ability for people to have gender-affirming care. Bonus article nine, body dysmorphia in boys and men can fuel muscle obsession. So I reported on this earlier, and this is a good backgrounder on that. And bonus article 10 has some related information. Six things to know about dietary supplements marketed for bodybuilding or performance enhancement. The bottom line is that some of these are dangerous, and it gives you some evidence on what ones work and what ones don't. Bonus article 11, research with exotic viruses risks a deadly outbreak, scientists warn. This is a really good long read background piece on what's going on with virus research. So if you're interested in that, great long read. Bonus article 12, Medicare tests a solution to soaring hospice costs. Let private insurers run it. When will we learn? So here we go. The privatization of hospice continues as Medicare starts expanding coverage for hospice costs. 13, I'm a biopharma supply chain specialist, and even I can't find the Adderall I'm prescribed. Transparency is missing in supply chain. So this is an interesting just personal story, but also it gets at the policy issue that part of the problem is you don't know what the problem is because there isn't transparency in the supply chains. Bonus article 14, possibilities of artificial intelligence in the practice of medicine. So this is a good article that talks about some mostly the positive things in the areas of medicine that AI could be helpful. So if you're interested in learning about that, great article. Bonus article 15, health insurance makes many kinds of hospital care more expensive. So this actually, there's two things. This cuts against one thing that's commonly understood and I've personally experienced where people that are uninsured actually pay more than people who have insurance or what the insurance company is paying. But the way it breaks down is where there's procedures that are paid out of the pocket and people or the types of procedures that people can shop around ahead of time. Those types of care is actually might be cheaper because they understand people who don't have health insurance are going to be price sensitive and want those more competitive prices. But for most of healthcare that we don't have a chance to really shop around for, you know, emergencies or, you know, a doctor refers to a place or does a surgery and we don't really, it's not like we're saying, well, let me get a second and third opinion or go to another surgeon or something like that. Those cases, health insurance actually leads to more expensive care. So much for the wonders of the free market and another perversity in American healthcare. Bonus article 16. Here's a new data point for cancer patients to consider: time toxicity. So that's just a fancy term for the fact that the medicalization of cancer treatment takes a lot of time to go to treatments, to be in treatment. And that whole time has a value and an effect on one's life. So avoiding the medicalization of one's life is not a bad thing to avoid. Bonus article 17, we're treating low back pain all wrong. We need to expand non-pharmacological approaches. So basically there's a lot of proven approaches that work besides giving drugs or doing surgeries. And this isn't just low back pain, it's all kind of chronic pain, but a good background or article on that. Bonus article 18, functional neurological disorders still carry stigma. And if you're wondering what functional neurological disorder is, then it kind of proves the point. Actually, the functional neurological disorder is just as common as MS and Parkinson's, but it's actually more predominant among women and carries a stigma as this, quote, you know, kind of being in your head type of thing, but it's a real disorder that causes huge problems, devastating problems. Bonus article 19, chronic health conditions in incarcerated people in the U.S. are likely severely undertreated. And that kind of goes under the heading of duh. Bonus article 20, emergency rooms need clear guidelines about how to handle law enforcement. So this falls under the category of there's very few situations that law enforcement can't make worse. And when law enforcement is present, like in an emergency room, it doesn't usually help, usually harms. 21, almost 90% of U.S. MPOX-related deaths were in black men, CDC reports. Just another example of racialization impacting the health of Americans. 22, black men face many more health hurdles. An expert discusses why. So a broader view of why black men specifically have disparities in their health. 23, chronic stress and mental illness. So this is a larger article that goes through and is a very good rundown of all the effects of chronic stress has on mental health illness related processes within our bodies, but also gets at the larger point that, you know, mental health care tends to be downstream, meaning that we're like, you know, with drugs and that type of thing, whereas if you're looking upstream and trying to avoid stress in the first place, might actually be a more productive way of dealing with the, quote, mental illnesses that are caused by stress. And it's a little bit of just, you know, pathologizing, you know, our stress responses. 24, polypharmacy isn't the answer for adolescent mental health. Again, an over-medicalization and an inadequate access to non-pharmaceutical interventions. Polypharmacy just meaning being on more than one drug. Bonus article 25. We need a way to tell useful mental health tech from digital snake oil. So over 100 years ago, the FDA, which hadn't existed prior to that, people could pretty much put anything in food or drugs, snake oil, and call and make any claim they wanted. FDA got down to applying some science to that so people consumers could actually tell what was going on. We need a parallel thing with mental health tech apps and such. What ones actually work so consumers can sort that out for themselves with a lot of help. Bonus article 26. People with Down syndrome are living longer, but the health system still treats many as kids. So back in the 50s, people with Down syndrome, the average life expectancy was 4. Now it's like 58. Woohoo! Big public health medical win. But of course, the health system has to adjust to treat the longer, more chronic conditions that are present in Down syndrome now that they're living longer. 27. What superagers show us about longevity and cognitive health as we age. That is basically the value of healthy lifestyles and strong social connections. Strong social connections is a great buffer for both longevity and cognitive health. 28. Education and peer support cut binge drinking by National Guard members in half. So I just include this because it's another good news story and just an example of the many opportunities for very cost-effective type of things. This was an online, self-viewed educational thing. And it was followed up by like monthly calls by somebody who would just touch bases with them. Somebody who was qualified in a peer that would touch bases and talk about issues of drinking and such. And it worked very well. Fairly low resource intensive. 29. Now is the time to build up public health departments, not shrink them further. So this is just an editorial by a couple Chicago former local public health directors. Good backgrounder on kind of the challenges of public health. And 30, last but not least, this one gets at what I've reported on before about income support or like minimum basic income, except this one is specifically targeted towards moms, expectant moms and moms. 4 Philly moms explain how cash for expecting parents could be transformative in America's poorest big city. Sometimes the simplest things are easy to do. A doctor can prescribe a drug that'll cost $20,000 a year, but they can't prescribe $1,000 a month for 18 months to some of the most vulnerable people in the country. You can see these and all the stories I reported in this and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.